Thank you again for staying here. So I see it's already again 11 o'clock. Number one, I hear here there is a gentleman from Austria, and this reminds me of something. When the Germans had invaded our village, boom, 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 and they took our house for a lazaret, as they call it, for the wounded soldiers, because they were fighting all around our house. And this was just, we have two festive periods, the small one and the big one, in our villages in Flanders. And my mother had baked such nice bread, raisin bread. And she was hiding it under the almira because glass might fall, because they were shooting everywhere. And then there was one soldier who was shot in the thigh. And my mother, being compassionate, she said, "Please have some of our bread." And he was eating it. So my father knew a little German. He had been a prisoner in Germany for 54 months. He came back as a skeleton after the First World War. So he could talk a little German. And I still remember what this Austrian said. He was eating and eating, and he said, "Hitler? Ach nee, das wissen Sie nicht. Das ist ein anderer Christus. You don't know who Hitler is. He's another Christ." That man who had been shot. This reminds me of this Austrian thing. So writing the book, I have said 3.5 years reading, 1.5 years writing, but when I had finished, I had more than 1,000 pages. So this I know is impossible. Publishing a book in 2 volumes is a catastrophe. People don't like to buy 2 volumes. 1 volume, you see, is already fat enough, so I have to cut. Now, when you have to cut things on which you have studied so much, it is you are as if you are cutting parts of your own flesh, you know? I had a chapter on Goebbels. Goebbels, the Catholic who found his heil in Hitler and who became the propaganda minister. I had to cut the whole thing. I had to see what is essential and not. So that is what remained. But then, this is one thing. The other thing is what is not written in that book. Because I could have written at least two more about essential subjects. Number one, why so much human flesh? Why is so much human flesh needed so that evolution can go on? If you study history a little, why so much human flesh? Genghis Khan and his pyramids of skulls. Passchendaele, 360,000 young men in Ypres, 420 in the battles of Ypres. All over the world, Guam. The bombings, the things, this is only one period. Throughout history is the killing, the killing, the killing. Why is so much human flesh needed for that? And this I find a very important question at the present moment. At the present moment, there are 6.5 billion people on the earth. When I was born, there were 3. When I came to Oroville, there were 350 million Indians when I came here. Now there are 1,100. In the time that I have been here, it has more than doubled. We are living at an extremely critical point in history, where, as I have said, and I'm always saying, the only interpretation is Sri Aurobindo and the Mother's vision. But don't be mistaken, there are no interpretations for what is happening now. There is only political rhetoric.
The high religion.
And whatever they do, they have to solve, from whatever party of opinion they are, they have to solve practical problems. What is happening, only we have an interpretation, and we have the means, through our own development, to collaborate. Why so much human flesh? And you never find an answer anywhere, except in India. Here in the Gita, Krishna reveals himself to Arjuna in all his glory, brighter than 1,000 suns. These are the words Oppenheimer will remember when he sees the explosion of the first atom. In all his glory, and then he reveals himself in all the horror. Seeing thy great form of many mouths and eyes, says Arjuna, O mighty armed, of many arms, thighs and feet and bellies, terrible with many teeth, the world and its nations are shaken in anguish, and also am I. I see thee touching heaven, blazing of many hues, with open mouths and enormous burning eyes. As I look upon their mouths, terrible with many tusks of destruction, thy faces like the fires of death and time, I lose sense of the directions and find no peace. This is in the Gita. And then Sri Aurobindo writes, it is only a few religions which have had the courage to say without any reserve, like the Indian, that this enigmatic world power is one deity, one trinity, to lift up the image of the force that acts in the world, in the figure not only of beneficent Durga, but of the terrible Kali in her blood-stained dance of destruction. And to say, this too is the Mother. This also know to be God. This too, if thou hast the strength, adore. And it is significant that a religion which has had this unflinching honesty and tremendous courage has succeeded in creating a profound and widespread spirituality such as no other can parallel. For truth is the foundation of real spirituality, and courage is its soul. This is one question. And there is something I forgot to explain before the tea. There is so much ignorance about what happened. The first lesson was how ignorant I am myself. Now I have read a little about that. I know something about that. I can confront many people on historical basis and say it might be like this. But what do I know about the unlimited vastness of all the other subjects? I know a little about this, I know a little about that. A little more here because I have spent so many years of my life. It's a problem also in the yoga. Who has the time to read? Who has the interest to read and to reflect? And who has the capacity to read on that level and digest and make it, turn it into practical effect? So you see, when you consider that, then you see humanity floating like leaves on a pond, moved by the waves in the water and moved by the wind. The flowers are there, the leaves are there, the life is there, but it is rooted in such a deep ignorance. And that, of course, for the University of Human Unity is one of the big reasons that it should be there, to bring consciousness, to bring awareness, to give explanations and to be able to talk with people who do not have the same view, either because they are against or because they don't know or because they have not gone deep enough into it. A second point that is not written is, for instance, the mother's appearance to Hitler before the invasion of Russia. Several people have come and say, "Oh, you have forgotten that." I say, "I have not forgotten at all. But I could not write it. The first thing, I have gone up to January 41 as long as the window spoke. The invasion of Russia is 42. Number one, historically I cannot justify it. The mother said 2 days later it happened. Now, the invasion of Russia was planned immediately after the conquest of France, a year before. All the armies were ready 2 days before, of course. And this makes me say, concerning the flight of Hess, that Hitler did not know anything about it. As I have written here, his invasion armies were there, the biggest invasion tanks numbers and whatever cannon in history. How could he depend this, make it depend on a circus act of a flight to England? So the mother, what she very probably has happened, and this is an interpretation, Hitler, before he had to do the big acts, was extremely nervous, and he would postpone, and he would do that, and he would do that. She has come and made him do. 2 days later it happened. So he was always so nervous and hesitated to make decisions. His God told him. He was always inspired. He's very intelligent, but it is the intelligence of his asura, said Sri Aurobindo. This is number one, I cannot justify historically. Number two, to write such a thing, I have to dedicate a chapter in its entirety to occultism. Number one, about the mother, who is she, and so on, and so on. And the second point is, what does that mean? So I am putting the whole kind of reasoning in this book. I would have had to put it into another perspective. And that is the reason I did not write it very well. Number three is, this is one act of the mother. She has said it has been like that all the time. And there is one thing for the people whom I have mentioned before, the war haters. We all hate war, of course. But the people who automatically discard things because of the face of this fellow, what is important is that the mother always has taken the fighters on their moment of death, in their moment of great courage, to whatever army or site or country they belong, they always have them. And if there are many stories of fighters, what they have gone through, what has given them the power to be courageous, of course, of the dead man, we don't know what has happened in their time of death, but there has been so much courage on both fronts. And that also is evolution of humanity. Then there is the theodicy. Theodicy means justification of God in the face of all the suffering and all the iniquities of that humanity is subject to. Why does God allow that? How can a good God allow somebody to die of cancer, to be eaten up by cancer, to suffer? How can he allow Auschwitz, Dachau, Buchenwald? How can he allow the whole horrible history of humanity? Every religion has its justification. There is only one that goes into depth, and that is the one of Sri Aurobindo. So this would be a good subject to talk about next time, because it is a very long one. But there is one thing I want to go into as an illustration. I like to illustrate, make concrete what I am saying, and that is Albert Speer. An experience of Albert Speer. Who was Albert Speer? His name is written like that. Albert Speer was an architect who by chance had done something for Hitler. And Hitler was an architect. He deemed himself the greatest architect on earth. And he dreamt of building. I have given so many examples in the book, you know. So this young fellow, what he has done, he liked it. He was an intelligent fellow. He presented well. And he became one of the very few people, of the three people who have been quite intimate with him. Four. Speer, Hess, Eckhart, and the man who was shot in the night of the long knives. Yeah. No, Stoltenberg was never close to Hitler. Right. Exactly. So, Speer became very high. And when the minister of the works that were done in the Reich crashed in an accident, Hitler put Speer there. And Speer became the chief of 1,200 million slaves. Among them many Flemings and Norwegians and things, people who were taken everywhere to work in the factories, to build the airplanes and so on and so on. So Speer was an incredible, as an organizer, he was a genius. He was ruling all that. But of course, in the circle, in the inner circle of Hitler, there was much pulling and pushing for power and to be closest to the Führer. So Speer became the enemy of Göring. Göring was the friend of Himmler. Speer got ill, was taken up in a hospital of the SS, Himmler, and the director, the chief doctor of the hospital, was a friend of Himmler. And Himmler said, you know, this is the best occasion to get rid of that Speer. Now I read what Speer said. In January 1944, Speer was hospitalized for a serious knee and lung infection. The time was not opportune for him because Göring, always covetous of more power, had been intriguing against him. Using the sinister Martin Bormann to bring Speer in disfavor with Hitler. The medical institution where Speer's condition had grown critical and was a state-of-the-art party hospital at Hohenlichen, near Berlin, run by Dr. Karl Gebhardt. This was an SS Gruppenführer and the personal physician of Himmler, who, according to Speer, had directed Gebhardt to eliminate him. In his book Inside the Third Reich, Speer writes, "The doctors prepared my wife for the worst, that he would die. But in contrast to his pessimism, I myself was feeling a remarkable euphoria. All at once, the little room expanded into a magnificent hall. A plain wardrobe I had been staring at for 3 weeks turned into a richly carved display piece inlaid with rare woods. Hovering between living and dying, I had a sense of well-being such as I had only rarely experienced. That he writes in his official memoir. Afterwards, he has been interviewed for days and days by Gita Sereni, because Speer had escaped execution at Nuremberg, being one of the leaders of the Reich who had organized all these death camps, working camps. He had escaped by collaborating with the Allies. And he had got only 20 years of prison. When he came out of prison, Gita Sereni, who has written several books on these subjects, went to interview him. Because her point was, if you have done all that, you must have known what the people were suffering, and you must have known what the Jews have suffered. But Peer had always said that he was ignorant. He had only organized. In Speer's conversations with Gita Sereni, however, we read what really happened. He, the very ambitious, very materialistic, and very matter-of-fact architect, powerful minister, and top Nazi, had a near-death experience. I have to say something, remind me of near-death experience. He had a near-death experience during the war. As Sereni reports that conversation, Speer said, "I have never been so happy in my life." He was above, he said, looking down at himself in bed. He says, "I saw everything very clearly. The doctors and nurses hovering, and his wife Margaret looking sort of soft and slim, her face small and pale. What Professor Koch, the surgeon, and the nurses were doing looked like a silent dance to me. The room was so beautiful." He smiled at the memory. "I was not alone. There were many figures, all in white and light gray, and there was music." And then somebody said, "Not yet." And I realized that was meant that I had to go back, and I said I didn't want to. But I was told I had to. It was not yet my time. What I felt then was something I know how to describe, was not something I know how to describe. It was just sadness or disappointment. It was a long feeling of loss when he had to go back into his body. To this day, I think that I felt things in those hours which the man I know myself to be cannot feel or see or say. I tell you one thing, I've never been afraid of death since. It certainly will be wonderful." Top Nazi, second word. So, why am I saying that? Because that man was in back. That man in charge of such an important factor in the Third Reich. Who decides? Why? What? Why so much flesh to make evolution progress? Who decides why, what, wherefore? And this is a very concrete example. Nazi, top Nazi, Second World War, near-death experience. Now, what I wanted to say is, in my biography of the mother, I have written extensively about the bridges that she built between, for the death to pass from this life into the psychic world. Because it is known everywhere in occultism and in all spiritualities, in the books of the dead in Tibet and in Egypt, that hell are the vital worlds through which the soul has to pass when it is not longer protected by the fortress, material fortress of the body. And when it has gone through that, where it can stay very long and even get lost, as the mother has described about a boy she had known which she met there, and then it goes into the mental world, then it goes into the psychic world. So the mother has said explicitly around her 20th year that it was one of her tasks for which she had come in this life to build the bridges between material life and the psychic world. And this is what you see always, that light and this protection. And since then, so many reports of near-death experiences everywhere. I have never had any reaction to this so important fact. People are just reading over it. You know what the mother has done, what Sri Aurobindo has done. But here you have such an unexpected illustration of these things. It must be wonderful. The beings were there waiting. Have you ever seen all that jazz? The film which gives the lives of a great American choreographer who has directed the film himself. And all the time, when that man who runs with women and these and all that, when he is alone, takes his pills to go on, pills to sleep, pills to stay awake. It's an incredible film. To stay awake, yeah. The show must go on. The show must go on. And then comes the death. An incredible choreography with his wife and his daughter. And then he dies. And the body bag is closed. And who stays there at the end? The woman who was always, to whom he was always talking, an invisible person when he was alone, she is awaiting to take him. In an American film about a modern choreographer, you find again the same things. It is so touching, it's such a great film, all that jazz. And the actor is the same as the one in Jaws, you know. Now, I'm not going to keep you longer anymore. I have always written this book with Germany in mind. I dare to say that. And I was always thinking, because I have German friends, how today, let's say, Orwellians in Germany, Orwell International Germany, whether they are here or there, everybody is working for the same thing, how they could work on these memories. What has touched me so much and has been a great lesson, this is how a whole culture could be living under a glass dome, where their thoughts and their actions and everything was dictated, allowed, spied on, and just directed by Hitler through his mouthpiece Goebbels. This whole society was living in a religion. Don't forget, Hitler, you don't know him, das ist ein anderer Christus. He was the Messiah, literally. I have all the proofs here, all the documentation. And they were dedicating their life. And the first ones had been critical because they had come from a more or less democratic society. But the younger generations, who were 44 and 45, were brainwashed. The young lieutenants and all those, the whole SS and all the rest, they were literally brainwashed. And you have, for instance, films like Die letzte Brücke, who are incredible. These are boys, 14, 15, 16 years, who are fighting to death, you know, for the Führer. And you see this whole society with all the explanations why they were leaving, their future, they would become the greatest on the earth, their future, their Führer was a being of light sent to guide them. And then all at once, how could these people react to the downfall? How could these people react to the collapse? They who had been true believers, putting their life on the line day after day. So you see, they didn't speak. The ones who had kicked others to death, the ones who had fought and been the masters, the ones who had been in Paris on the Champs-Élysées, the ones who had been in Russia, how could I talk about it? About big experiences, true experiences, one cannot talk. It's the same from the people who came back from the concentration camps. And it's the same for me when I go back to Belgium. And I say, how is India? What can you say? It's very hot there. And many people are very poor. Let's have another beer. True experience cannot be spoken. Like Wittgenstein said, worüber man nicht sprechen kann, darüber soll man schweigen. About what you cannot speak, you should keep mum. But then I say, you cannot speak about anything. How can I speak about a rainy day? How can I speak about the love I feel? How can I speak about when I have pain in my heart? How can I speak about the nightmares I have? You cannot speak about anything. But everybody is using that, you know, when they don't agree with what the other is saying. What you cannot speak about, you should keep mum. I have always been thinking about Germany. And then it is very clear that the younger generation, of course, has no guilt. But what is happening very often, there are waves that they are trying to justify what has happened at that time. Through resistance to communism, through this, through that, there are waves like that. And then there is something very important in Germany. Germany has closed off its soul. Why? They don't dare to open that. Because once this came out, don't forget that soul and vital very often are identified. Here the higher vital behind it by way of speaking the soul. They are on the same. And very often the soul is identified with the feeling. In philosophy and in all psychological things, you always read the same nonsense. We are so lucky to have such fundamental literature based on experience, personal and from the times before. So there is a fear. And if you look at the Germany after the war, everything is great. Their films are great. Their way of life is great. It was, of course, very difficult. But everything has mental. So there, I was always thinking of these people. I will be dead for many years before ever my book comes into Germany. I know that. But I have always been thinking about these problems, because they are also the problems of my friends. And this, of course, goes together not only with Germany, but also with France. Don't forget, as I said before, that Hitler could have come by way of speaking from France. Many were expecting something from there. There was a huge movement against the Jews and nationalists going back to the past, the idealized past, that you won't read very often anymore, no? Because once, after the war, they had all been in the resistance. But then who was Vichy? You know, France had been divided into five parts. One part went back to Germany, one part was Belgium and things just for gain, the other part were all the things along the coast, and then there was the other part, biggest, Vichy, and then there was the part Mussolini had taken. When the war was over, Mussolini came and he also got his share of the cake. All these things are not talked about anymore. This whole mentality before the war, during the war. And then there is something very important for the situation today for Europe. You have that Germany that hesitates to give full gas, full power of its potential. That has this heavy past always associated with it. Even if you don't think of it, there is a kind of hidden remembrance. You have France that has betrayed its soul. In what way? Well, if the Aurobindo has fought the good fight for the Second World War, it was because he said what France has acquired, what humanity has acquired in France, should not be lost. What was it? Liberté, égalité, fraternité. Liberty, equality, fraternity. Humanity should keep that. And that, of course, was just the opposite of what Hitler would have introduced and was introducing in Germany during all these years, conditioning like that. So on the one side, Germany, on the other side, France, who had betrayed in a kind of collaboration with this, they are the two pillars of Europe. And this explains fundamentally the problems of Europe at present. Because if you listen to Mark Leuch and you read the book, or the two books he has written, it's exactly about that. The loss of any inner direction, intuition, inspiration, and daring. The ideals of Europe for what it stands for. It's an important fact. So then, I was 10 years older, and one morning we knew, of course, about the invasion in Normandy, but we were occupied in Belgium. And I lived in a village, 3,000 people, a very beautiful village, and one morning, 6 o'clock, there they were, a whole army of Germans in retreat. And they withdrew a whole day long, from 6 o'clock in the morning till 11 o'clock at night. You should have seen that, the shambles in which the army was. Their shirt was hanging through their pants, they were riding, they stole everything they could find, and they were riding on cycles without tires, because we didn't have rubber anymore at that time. And so on and so on. And it was raining all day. I was a small boy. And it was raining so heavily, just like when again they were taking shelter in the door of a neighbor. We, of course, my God, we had been through that whole war. These airplanes, we were on the corridors from southern England to Germany. We always saw the airplanes coming and the airplanes going, and at night the same. And when they came, there were formations, and when they came back, there were not formations, and there were stragglers, and sometimes you saw a little red dot on one of the wings, one of the engines on fire, and then you saw some dots coming out of the thing, and all they became white when the parachutes opened. And the whole neighborhood took its cycle and was running, you know, to see the parachutists, but normally the Germans were first there. So we were living in that, we were occupied, we were very afraid. One day when Santa Claus came, I was a little boy, so Santa Claus was somebody from the neighborhood who came to say, have you been a good boy, and what would you like from Santa Claus, you know? And when Santa Claus left, the door went open, and there fell some light from our corridor in the street. immediately Zweifeldwebel, military police. And we were booked and we had to pay a fine. But two, these were big fellows, I assure you, with their iron breastplate. And my brother-in-law, who died 2 weeks ago, was sitting there. At that time he was courting my sister, 20 years old. And these two Feldwebel, they could just have taken him and sent him to Germany. So then a little later, a woman in the neighborhood was shot point blank from this distance with her baby on her arm, because her brother had run away. He did not want to go and work in Germany and all such things. So we went through that, and this whole army now was withdrawing. And me, little fellow, I saw these pistols, no? We had armies with real weapons. We had just found here, these, that, everywhere, all kind of trash. Some were not working, but some were. And I went to my mother and said, can you give me some slices of bread? Because they are so hungry, you know. And I went to this. And they didn't look like Germans anymore. They may have been Croats, or they may have been Hungarians, or I don't know. I say, here. Oh, thank you very much. And I stroked over my head. I said, can I have your pistol? And the man, he smiled and said, we are going to throw this. So it was raining, weather like this. The next day, when they were 10 kilometers farther, the sun shone. And there they came, ta 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 ta. And I just had my first cycle, a small cycle from Santa Claus. And the whole neighborhood on Sunday, dressed in their best, went to see the battlefield. And the same brother-in-law said, why don't you let him come? I will take care of him. I will remain thankful to him ever to have seen. And we went to see the battlefield. And there was a German soldier laying half in the water of a small brook. And they were shooting farther on. And a reconnaissance plane came. And the man showed where they were. Artillery, horses everywhere with big parts cut out for eating, shot dead horses who were shot dead. And then I looked over the wall, somebody put my up over the wall of that town, which is the town of Guy Reichardt. He was born there on the day of the liberation. And there was a cemetery with heaps of German soldiers up to the sea. Maybe the ones to whom I have given that bread the day before. So this is a story of participation in a way. But that was not all. After the war in Flanders, we are a very small place. So all the films we get, we always got them in the original languages with subtitles, which was very instructive. We followed in French and in German and in English. So there was the whole filmology of that time, you know, with all the first films, Der Teufelsgeneral, and so on, and the French one. We lived in that atmosphere. So in fact, this is also one of the motives that I have written it out just by studying the history and realizing how little I knew and how much I had to find out to make something coherent and make a book of it that could be read by people who had the means to judge it. While I was writing for 5 years, I had a very tough time. And sometimes I had nightmares. And towards the end, one nightmare was an abyss, black can be, with 4 black poles, and 2 of these poles were helmeted. There were helmets on these. And I was sliding into that abyss. And then a young girl came and pulled me up and saved me. Normally, when one has a nightmare, one should not try to interpret, just let it work, otherwise one fixes it. But here it became so clear, it was so clear at once. You have the four asuras. Two are still active, two are helmeted, you know, and just pulling you down into that. But then I had a compensation also. This was another dream, so lively that it is one of the supports of my life. It was a long road, and in a ditch, an Indian woman was giving birth. She is living in Oroville. An Indian woman was giving birth, and I was helping with bringing the baby into the world. And I took it then into my arms, and I went on the road, and there was this golden mountain, like a sun coming up behind it, you know. So this was a very nice. So you are compensated with the one and with the other when you are in the battle. Now, I want to finish. Last time, when Roth introduced me, he said that I was an expression or something of the historical mind. Now, if there is something I do not feel like, it is that. I am not interested in history except for the stories. Reality is always more fantastic than imagination. And who has said that so clearly? A famous man who died 2 days ago, Arthur Clarke, who was living in Sri Lanka, the famous science fiction writer, who has said very many nice things. Reality is always more fantastic than imagination. So, but that is history. I am only studying and going to the things because of now, of Sri Aurobindo and the mother. There is something I want the answers to, and I find the answers in them, and I find them worked out in their action, in their writings. And all that refers to the past. Because Sri Aurobindo and the mother have an incredible horizon of knowledge. You know, you can go on and write 750 books and it will still not be exhausted. There is so much there. So far from being a historical mind, I just try to assimilate, to give color, to give relief, to give life to what I find here. Everything is meaningful. Everything from then is meaningful now. And that is the great genius of the vision of Sri Aurobindo. When you read in him about Socrates, when you read in him about Heraclitus, when you read in him about Christ, it has always meaning, practically speaking, now. And here I stop my eye talk, sorry for the much eye. But I think if I only speak in abstractions, a talk like this does not make much meaning. Therefore, I want to give some concrete examples, and I like to refer because I am nobody. I have no degree. I always have to have my references ready, and this makes it so difficult to write because you have to read so much. And you have to assimilate before you can sit down and write, because then everything must be present. It is not a matter of excerpting or whatever a book one has read. One has to make the assimilation and put it together. And the second point that I don't think the historical mind is very much justified, because I have so much the awareness that the mind could, as it were, be peeled off. It is an eternal dread, especially for somebody who has reached my age, that knowledge could just be peeled off. But what is important is what one becomes inside. And all this, I am very glad that it is given to me to work in this way. And it is always a satisfaction when somebody comes and say, I have enjoyed or I have appreciated something you wrote, because it goes here, there and everywhere. I never had thought that it would come here, but we have taken the decision to give this series of talks, rain or no rain, thunder or no thunder, we go out, and maybe after the summer. Next week is I give a talk about the bombardier beetle. Ha! Peter is the bombardier beetle. Have you ever heard about that?
No.
You won't believe it. I know that for a very long time. Just 2 days ago, I often zap through the channels when I am eating or something to know what is going on in the world. What do I see? A program on the bombardier beetle. Actually, it is the bombardier beetle. It's a very remarkable little animal that illustrates intelligent design. So next week I will talk about evolution and intelligent design. But I take this, you know, I am educated at the time. I was a writer, a playwright at the time of Ionesco, Beckett, Adamov and all these people. Absurd, theater of the absurd. So I like grotesque things. So the bombardier people, beetle that we do, like I say, what is that? It is about evolution and intelligent design. Thank you so much. Van Vrekken. It means from the house of the miser.
Yeah, thank you for this wonderful talk and giving us the background of the books that I've been reading this way and growing interest. Because there's so many, you know, I've admired your style of being able to, you know, when you describe one scene, being able to refer to so different historical sources and putting all the context in the piece, actually. I mean, it's something. I really like reading and getting so many impressions.
Just a question. You said before that you have this kind of like half of the book. This old material you have just told your research and it's gone.
You have another soft copy somewhere.
Make another one, but I wrote something
different. I just want to reflect, because I feel doubly happy. Like, I feel really happy to have been informed by you. But I also feel really happy for you, that you had a chance to tell us this to an audience that is appreciating, because I feel that's really a collegium. That's
absolutely
really what we're about. And I just, I want to draw attention to that, and I want to appreciate it so much.
If I talk so long, it is because the audience is receptive to the same, it is the next change. Otherwise, I will be gone and I'm out of this. Sure,
exactly. And personally, I have to say to Lawrence, together you have a huge, incredible amount of work, research, of facts, of assimilations, of many, many, many informations, as you said. So there is a huge mental work, which is absolutely amazing. And you restitute and you put it in a kind of cradle of loving personal generosity and genuineness. I'm very sensitive of the kind of human wisdom that is actually appearing, emerging from it. And I'm very moved, and I thank you so much.
There is one something I forgot to and that is that we are all absolute beginners. This is my very strong conviction in this yoga, we are all absolute beginners. Wherever we may be and however long we may be, we can continue. But when I saw the mother the first time, it was an incredible experience. And at the end, when she called me back, because I was completely gone, and then she told my dad, who just smiled, you know, and she gave me one blessing. And then she gave me a second. So I always suppose, my supposition, that the second one is for this.
I see it's only 1 to 12. Because I remember now suddenly, years ago you came to an older AVI meeting in Germany talking about a similar topic regarding German history and past. And we in Germany since 50 years are really trying to get to grips with our own history and the evolutionary context of it. And in this regard, and I found uplifting and very remarkable how you could produce to us who are very much, how to say, bogged down by that, and how you could lift that up into an evolutionary perspective, which is a human story or a human topic. And yeah, and that you know very well, since a long time searching for German identity in regard to the international zone, and in regard to the story in our world, I found it a very particular, very special moment. And actually, through Schirrbindo, me personally, it was a release, the first time in my life, find an explanation of the world and humanity and man, which opened up totally my longing, my being, to something which gave explanation to all. Because having been born in 42 in Berlin, and living through all the stories of divided worlds whatsoever, divided worlds, violence and power. I found it the first time that somebody could explain to me everything. And really giving the whole picture why. You said a very strong question. Why is all that misery? Why is all that? And coming from a Christian background, not moralic background, romantic background, and the suppression of the evil in one's own being, such an important, not important, the gift which you described so well and named it.
Maybe I would like also to thank Georges, especially since I read his manuscript before it was published. We discussed with him a little bit of his book, and what my impression was very interesting, because it seems that the material was so attracting to go to these horrors. And Georges never went into that direction. Never presented it in sensual way, as it is usually presented.
Sensation?
Yes. Not sensation, sensual. I mean sensual. when senses are frightened. When with frightened senses you will misjudge material. And sensational also, yes. But he presented it in a way where you could see how truth was mixed with falsehood in such a degree that you cannot distinguish anymore. All the speeches, all the direction, how it was taken up, was suddenly justified in this perspective. And I could really see how difficult it was and impossible it was to fight this asura of falsehood. How clever he was, how truly he spoke, and how the whole nation could respond to that, because there was a sincerity. There was knowledge which was always hidden somewhere in the history. Nobody wanted to admit certain things, but they were there, known to all. So they were drawn to the surface and they were used for this particular movement. And it was a revelation for them to see how it was built up. One thing, of course, you write Hitler and his God, and I always look for this second title, his God. What is that thing behind? What is that God? And it seems you are not answering it directly, but it is somehow present there as a supposed or presupposed meaning to all that what happened.
I could not make the propaganda writing, especially your window and the mother of that. I always have to try and have to keep it to a self-funny, intelligent reader. And this is what I am trying to do. I try to bring some aspect of the agreement and the model for people, intelligent readers, but that about that historical thing also, Peter Hitch, for instance, was writing for the very positive review about my biography of the mother, and he said, well, Brecken is not a historian. I don't want to be a historian. How can I, being a student and student, how can I take the historical stance and insert the reader and the mother historically in that? First of all, I am much too small, and the second point is, if you do that, then you are taking away all the spiritual essence and the spiritual favor, a favor. Because if there are many ways of being a historian. Homeros was a historian for the Greeks. Then you have their way of writing history afterwards. All the stories they found, great stories, they were historians. But then you have in the Middle Ages, this kind of historian. Now you have what is a historian? He is a rational, materialistically judging man. So as soon as you bring something that is not materialistic into it, you are not longer considered to be a historian. But my God, then why should I write about fear every morning? So what I try to do is to make something intelligible, digestible, interesting for intellectual people, intelligent people who are interested in this subject. And if they are not interested in this one, well, then you have time for even another one. Not of me, but of somebody else. It's a matter of interest. But what you bring honestly, and you bring the whole view. And this is not considered to be historical. I am a historian.
I am a devotee of the Arvino and the mother writing about it.
You like it, you don't like it.
For the Chinese, for Confucius, you would be a gentleman. A gentleman can see a question from all sides without bias. The ordinary man is biased and can see a question from only one side.
I think I would confusion. Because we are a gentleman, and we are a gentleman.
Thank you, George.
Thank you, George.
We finish with a minute of silence? Just 1 minute. 1 second.